Thank you very much, Lars. I'm particularly grateful for a brief introduction. And thanks for the hospitality of ITP, KITP. Almost to the day, 46 years ago, the first satellite went up. Russia put it up. It was called Sputnik, before some of you were born or perhaps in grade school. But I remember it vividly. It was an enormous jolt to the self-confidence of the United States, who was feeling quite good about itself up to that very point. The real significance of space and Sputnik and the feasibility of going into space and doing useful things became apparent, not immediately, but as time wore on. The two most important applications of space that we're all aware of are communication satellites, and by that I include DirecTV that some of you may watch, and all that that connotes. And the other was GPS, the global positioning system, and those of you that are boaters or hikers or surveyors or even scientists know all about that. And but as important as those two applications are, they are overshadowed and were preceded by an even more important application of space technology, and that was reconnaissance from Earth orbit, taking pictures from 100 miles up of the Earth's surface. It's of interest that that began. The first successful flight took place just 16 months after Sputnik went up. And as I'll point out in a moment, it was the first vehicle to be recovered from space, well before men were recovered either by Russia or by the United States. Others have argued persuasively, I think, that satellite reconnaissance is one of the three really important military technology achievements of the last century. And those people who study these matters say that only the atomic bomb and radar rise to this level. Radar really helped to win the Second World War, and the bomb, whatever its problems, clearly terminated the war in a quick way. But satellite reconnaissance carried us through four frightening decades of the Cold War, and kept the peace. And for that reason, I think it's of substantial interest to people of all persuasions. They were a powerful stabilizing influence, the product of these satellites in the Cold War, and tended to back off from a hair trigger situation the nuclear stockpiles that both parties maintained. And there's absolutely no doubt that this photography made it possible to negotiate the sweeping arms limitations agreements that were concluded between the Soviets and the United States. My purpose today is simply to describe what happened 40 years ago, give you a sense of history. The first of the programs was called Corona. It means it was just drawn at random out of a book of names that are used for this purpose. So Tony's already asked that question. And it means absolutely nothing, and it's chosen to mean absolutely nothing. But it sticks, and it's so the satellites were called Corona. Because I'm at ITP, I want to advise you that that physicists in particular, and scientists generally, were absolutely key to starting this and other important reconnaissance programs. They had done so in stimulating the development of the U-2 airplane for doing the same job, and the Mach 3 airplane that followed it, which most of you would know as the SR-71, or the Blackbird, which in fact was, as the U-2 was, a CIA Air Force collaboration. And so was the Corona, by the way. How did these scientists get into the act, you might ask, and how did the physicists play such a role? And it really began quite by coincidence. Eisenhower, when he came back from the war in Europe, became the president of Columbia University for a brief period of time. And as Columbia, as university presidents do, they pal around with one another. And he became closely connected to Jim Killian, who was then the president of MIT. And they really liked each other, and they really trusted each other. And so Killian became really his mentor on things scientific. Although Killian himself was not a physicist, not a scientist, but he had a wonderful way of bringing scientists together, and that was his skill as a university president. When Eisenhower was elected in 1952, came to office, he turned to Killian, almost one of his first acts, and requested that Killian gather together some of his really first-class scientists to see what could be done to reduce the threat of surprise attack with nuclear weapons, which were then a problem on both sides because they were shifting from airplane delivery to missile delivery with only a 30-minute warning time. And that really put nuclear delivery on a hair trigger. I should tell you that Truman also had been very concerned about this matter. Eisenhower's predecessor, they shared a real concern. They both lived through Pearl Harbor and what a surprise attack meant, and they were absolutely determined to prevent it happening again and to try to stabilize the general environment that creates surprise attacks. Killian recruited Edwin Land. Some of you will remember him, the man who invented the Polaroid camera and made a ton of money, but he was a fine optical scientist. Ed Purcell at Harvard, physicist, Nobel laureate. John Tukey, a distinguished mathematician at Princeton, who you may have remembered, David. Al Donovan, a wonderful aeronautical engineer at Cornell Aero Lab. And who am I leaving out? Jim Baker at Harvard Observatory, a terrific telescope designer, one of the people who really knew how to design lenses and optical trains. And this very small group came to exert enormous influence on the whole business of reconnaissance, namely improving our eyesight and our hearing in dangerous years. This group was later joined by people that some of you will probably know better. Sid Drell, now at Stanford, at SLAC, and Dick Garwin. Both joined the Land group, the Land-Killian group, soon after its forming and have continued to the present day to play an extraordinarily influential role in national decision-making in the reconnaissance field. I once asked Land, who I got to know quite well, obviously, why he and others spent so much of their time, and it was a major commitment of time, to the question of reconnaissance. And Land looked me in the eye and he said very simply, he said, look, this country cannot afford to defend itself from all possible threats. We must know what we're up against and then focus our limited resources in that direction. And only by so doing can we get through the Cold War peaceably. I took those words to heart, and that's how I happened to go to Washington when asked. And as I indicated, they were really the spark plug that persuaded Eisenhower that the U-2 could be built and should be built, and the same way with the Mach 3 airplane. In the aftermath of the Sputnik launch in October 1957, we had a lot of things to think about. But Eisenhower turned again to the Killian group and said, now that space is real, are we on the right track on satellite reconnaissance? And asked them to take a look at what was going on in the Air Force. They did. They found that it was a program in great disarray. The organization RCA that was responsible for building the camera system would, in 3 months' time from asking that question, resigned from the program saying they simply couldn't do it. And so we were trying more than technology would really allow at that time. More fundamentally, the Air Force, the SAMOS program, was focused on the wrong problem. In those days, the Strategic Air Command and Curtis LeMay really ran the Air Force, and what he wanted to do was what the Air Force wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was to count bomb craters after the first strike had been delivered, to see if the bomb damage assessment, there's a code, a name for it, wanted to go out and count bomb craters and see if they'd gotten their targets, and if not, he was going to send a second wave. And so the SAMOS program had been focused on the job of fighting a nuclear war, of providing information for these commanders to when they're responsible, when they were called upon by the president. Eisenhower wasn't a bit interested in fighting a nuclear war. He wanted to preserve the peace at whatever cost. He'd already fought a war. He didn't want to do another one. And so they reported back to Eisenhower that that the SAMOS program was in trouble, probably wasn't going to work on any near term, but that there was an alternative. SAMOS, by the way, had very low resolution from 300 miles, and it used a television relay link down to the ground. Had a resolution of about 100 feet. Pretty hard to see anything except a crater with a 100-foot resolution. And they said that as they understood Eisenhower's needs, he wanted high resolution in peacetime before the war started to try to avert a conflict, and that there was a way to do it. That we could, in fact, put a camera in space with the rockets we were then building, that it could operate there, it could take photographs which could give very much better resolution than was being attempted, and the film cassette, the spool in your 35 millimeter camera, if you will, could be returned in a capsule to Earth, caught and the film processed, the film return system. They made this recommendation to Eisenhower, and 8 weeks later he gave the go-ahead for the system. It's an absolutely astonishing decision cycle. The short time spans in all of this is, I think, the thing that impresses me most as I go back to these times. And remember, I was just a working scientist and not in government when these decisions were being made. The management of the program was assigned to CIA, but with very strong Air Force support. An unusual arrangement, you say. Well, that's exactly the arrangement that had worked successfully on the U-2 and the Mach 3 airplane. The agency had two things going for it. One, it didn't report through a lot of layers of command and bureaucrats in the Pentagon. Two, it had demonstrated it could keep a project pretty quiet, as the U-2 had been. But more fundamentally, the Director of Central Intelligence has the authority, the statutory authority, to spend money on his own signature and need not go through the congressional process. He has to refill the pot from time to time, but he can simply write a check to do things. And so that, again, spelled quick action, and that's what was needed, obviously. This was a daring program. Richard Dussel at the agency, one of the senior agency officers, a PhD in economics, oddly enough, who had been a professor both at Yale and MIT, if I remember properly, chose Brigadier General Ozzie Ritland of the Air Force as his deputy, the man who had helped him do the preceding two projects, and they were off and running. The program office, the whole program was characterized by a leanness that's just unimaginable today. Ritland and Bissell were in Washington with about six CIA people. Six Air Force officers under Lee Battle were working in El Segundo, and that was it. That was the government program office. There were no program reports, no progress reports submitted. There were no monthly briefings. They simply did the job. To underscore the new way of doing business, Bissell drafted a work statement, the contract, if you will, for this activity, which would eventually spend $600 million in then your dollars. I brought a copy of that contract with me. It's a page and a half long. And it has a schedule on the third page, a schedule. What's breathtaking about it is not only its brevity, but its clarity. This document's dated 25 April 1958, just 6 months after Sputnik. It's the only contractual document that the Corona program ever had. And it was all they needed. But when you read this document, and I would encourage those of you that have time to come up and take a look at it, you can only gasp in astonishment. It says simply that the first Corona was to fly in March 1959, 11 months later, and that it was to achieve a resolution better than 25 feet on the ground. There was no description of how this was to be done in the work statement. Just here's what you're to do, go do it. And it's, I guess we could all wish for those kinds of contracts today. It was pretty clear that Bissell and Rutland had some major decisions to make very quickly in the next 6 weeks. And I'll describe a little bit how they did that. They were fortunate in that the Earth orbit, the right Earth orbit for doing satellite reconnaissance had been established, identified by RAND, who'd studied this problem endlessly for the Air Force in support of the SAC requirements. It's an orbit that lies in the spin axis of the Earth and intersects the Sun. And so it's a Sun-oriented plane and essentially a polar orbit. The apogee is 240 miles and the perigee varies. It's anywhere between 80 and 100. But the point is the apogee pins the period to an hour and a half. And so the satellite's going in this plane that's headed off toward the Sun. And on the pass this way, it's always guaranteed to get a sunlit portion of the Earth to photograph. An hour and a half later, it comes back, but by then the Earth has changed the scene, takes a new set of pictures. And in just a moment, well, that was as good a time as any. I'll show you the first slide. I don't think we need to change, well, maybe we do. Let's try it again. Here is actually the first flight that took place, and you can see these photographic passes coming down over the Soviet Union and China, going from the North Pole down toward the South Pole. And this is just the way this particular satellite was programmed. That's the kind of coverage that was potentially available with this orbit. This is where the cameras were turned on. You had the option to turn the camera, not just waste film. Film was pretty precious. And so the cameras were programmed on and off over targets of extraordinary interest. Okay.
What's in the ocean?
The legend? Oh, this is the Indian Ocean just here. I don't know.
Also north of Japan.
I don't know.
Soviet carrier.
I don't know.
What can you see as 25 feet resolution?
I'm sorry?
Can you see missiles with 25 foot resolution?
Could you repeat this question?
Can you see missiles with 25 foot resolution?
Well, I'm getting to that. The answer is yes. The first flight receives a little bit less, achieved a little bit less than 25, and that eventually went down to 6 feet. So it was pretty good. I'm going to show you lots of this photography by and by. I'm trying to lay the foundation of what was achieved in such an extraordinarily small time by a very few people. Now, in order to achieve this orbit coming from the North Pole down toward the South Pole, you had to launch in a northerly or a southerly direction. Most of the rockets were then being launched out of Florida. Can't do that from Florida because in the south you go over friendly countries and not so friendly countries going north, and Miami going north, you go over the eastern United States. So Florida was out. Vandenberg had just been built here. You can't go north, but you can go south. And so Vandenberg became the launch base, and it was used throughout the program, this and other programs, to launch this kind of satellite into this kind of orbit. It can, you know, the Earth, the coastline goes east-west here, if those of you who live here know. And so out on the tip, which is Point Arguello, where Vandenberg is, you can actually go dead south, and all the facilities were in there. Okay, this program had to be based on a proven rocket. We couldn't afford to build a rocket from scratch, or they couldn't. And there weren't many choices in 1958. That was the period when most rockets were blowing up at a great rate. Fortunately, the Thor, which I'll show you next, It was an intermediate range rocket, had a single engine of a thrust of about 150,000 pounds. It burned liquid oxygen and kerosene, and it had been developed. It had been flying for almost a year. It was actually in production. It was being deployed in Europe. But the most important thing is there was a launch pad for it and all the launch facilities at Vandenberg as a training base, but we could simply use that and go forward, so the gods were smiling on us at that point. So the first piece of the puzzle fell in place, and here it is, the Thor rocket. The problem is that the Thor was unable to get the cameras into the low Earth orbit, the reconnaissance orbit, if you will. It just wasn't powerful enough. It was only designed to go 1,500 miles as a ballistic rocket, and it didn't have enough push to get up and into this north-south reconnaissance orbit. So it was pretty clear that we needed to put a second stage on the Thor rocket and to carry the payload the rest of the way. Now the Agena was such a vehicle. It was in fact one of the only such vehicles. Here is the first model. It was mounted on top of the Thor. It had been under development for about 2 years. It was struggling. It was the first of such upper stage to really be developed. It again had an engine that had been borrowed from a bomber program, the B-58, if any of you remember that. 16,000 pounds of thrust, and it burned N204 and unsymmetrical dimethyl hydrazine, which is nasty stuff. But it did the job, and so Lockheed was building this stage, and it had never flown. It had a ways to go in its development, and they were trying to fly in 11 months. The second problem with using Agena is that it was designed really only as a dumb pusher. It was there to accelerate payloads into higher Earth orbit. And Bissell and Ritland wanted to use this as a housekeeping vehicle to go into orbit and then stay there and provide electrical power and attitude control and communications and thermal protection for the cameras. And it had never been conceived of that, but Lockheed was redirected to begin to make those modifications. And quite frankly, the problems that were experienced in the flight test program were in large part due to the fact that we simply asked too much of this vehicle on too short a time. What about the cameras? There were no cameras really in this class. This was probably the most important question that Ritland and Bissell had to answer. The grand studies for the Air Force had concentrated on a spinning camera, where they got the scan simply by the stabilized spin of the vehicle, but it didn't have any image motion compensation. And if you were looking for essentially very mediocre resolution, that was okay. But Ike wanted wanted very good resolution, and so they realized that they needed to go to a stabilized Agena vehicle and go to a panoramic camera. Perhaps without taking the screen up, I can simply show you. The idea is to build a telescope with lenses. Light comes in one end, goes through a lens train, comes out the other end, and then passes through a slit. And on a circular platen, you have the film held in place. And this camera then scans, and this telescope scans in this way, gradually reproducing on the film the image at the other end of the telescope. And when it reaches the end of about a 70-degree scan, then it resets while the film is being pulled forward and does the same thing again. By now, you've moved downstream a bit, and you're taking a new piece of photography. This panoramic camera is the kind that were used when you had your high school picture taken and someone always ran from one end to the other. But it's such cameras had been developed for some balloon reconnaissance programs by a very good group of people who during the Second World War were at Harvard University. Then after the war, Harvard wanted out. They went to BU, and finally BU wanted out. And just as this program began, about 100 of the very best camera designers who had built panoramic cameras were out of work. The agency stepped in, persuaded the Rockefeller family to fund these people, and the result was the ITEC Corporation. And they suddenly had a home and laboratories, and they built a these cameras. The telescope was a 24-inch focal length camera. It was an F5 Tesser optical train, if you're a camera buff. It operated, the lenses all operated just at the diffraction limit. And they required, interestingly enough, an extraordinarily pure kind of glass. In fact, there was only one source of such glass. It was the Schott Works in eastern Germany. Potentially a problem. The agency was able, all during the 12 years of the program, to spirit enough of this high-quality glass out of East Germany to supply the program. Okay, the... I won't say a whole lot more about it. But it was a showstopper, potentially. Here's how the... this actually, you'll forgive me, as time went on, the boosters got more capable than the Agena did, and we added a second camera and had stereoscopic. This shows the two-camera version. It was not the first camera. But what you see is these telescopes with a film above them and simply cutting a... covering a swath about 10 miles wide and about 10 miles along the velocity vector and 120 miles, 60 miles on either side of the flight path. Now, the optical design was later changed to a Petz ball, but 3.5, but that probably isn't very interesting to you. What about the film? Where did that come from? Again, they were lucky. Eastman Kodak had, under CIA sponsorship, established a special facility to manufacture and process film for the U-2 of an extraordinary quality. And they simply developed a 70 millimeter film for Corona, and that was an acetate-based film. It was only 3 mils thick, and that was important because you wanted to get as much film aboard as you could. It was very slow. It was an ASA rating of 2. And but you need a lot of photons to, you know, hit the silver crystals. But with these diffraction limited optics of the telescope and with this film, they were able to achieve 280 lines per millimeter at high contrast. Even at 2:1, they got 175. And if any of you are experimenters, you know that's pretty good. The best that had been achieved up to that point during the Second World War was 50 lines. So we went from 50 to almost 300 in this new film. The what about the caps? How are we going to get this film back from orbit once it's been reeled up and exposed? I remind you what I said at the beginning, a capsule had never been returned from space successfully, never even tried, and Corona was the first program to do it. It pioneered this whole technology that was used to bring John Glenn and others back. Fortunately, it could lean on a development in the ballistic missile program. Both the Army and the Air Force had learned how to use ablation cooling to essentially boil off material to get rid of the heat that's incurred during reentry. And that technology had been developed. It was available when Corona came along. And GE was contracted with to, or given the job of, because they didn't have a contract either, I don't think, to build a return capsule, which had in it, its main component was a big spool to reel up the 70 millimeter film. And there would sometimes be 16,000 feet of it, so there was quite a lot, to protect it on the way down through the heat conditions, and then to get it recovered. And we're going to explain all that. This reentry vehicle weighed about 414 pounds, and it had, depending on how much instrumentation, how much film was carried. And, well, I don't think I really wanted to show that again. Here's how it worked. When the mission was over and the film was all spooled up in the reentry capsule, the Agena would reorient itself, making a 120-degree angle with the velocity vector along the path. You can have a little fun if you want. You can work it out. That's the minimum energy. It takes the minimum delta V along that direction to get the vehicle back to Earth at 90 degrees around. And the vehicle was separated, the little capsule was, the reentry vehicle was separated, then it was spun up to provide stability. Then a rocket engine was fired that imparted 1,300 feet per second to it, and then it was despun, and then it came back into the atmosphere. It hit its maximum heating at about 350,000 feet, where the surface of this capsule gets up to 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But the ablation took care of that. A little later on, the heat shield was popped off, get it out of the way, and a cover was on the parachute pack in the back was popped off. And at about 50,000 feet, a parachute was deployed, which cut the sink rate to about 30 feet per second. All right, is everybody still with me? Remember, this was going to happen in 11 months. It had never happened before. The a fleet, first of all, we could, by controlling the attitude of the deburn, of the deboost, if you will, we could control the impact to an area about 400 miles by 150 miles. The signal to deorbit was given from Alaska as it went over the North Pole. About 90 degrees later, it was off Hawaii. And there we had deployed a number of assets, mostly C-119s with lariats that were being towed out of the cargo door. And the idea was that at about 15,000 feet where they could operate, they would go up and try to snag the parachute shrouds with the lariat that they pulled out the back end and then pull it in. I'm going to show you a picture of it. It really works. Pull it in and then take it back. If they failed to do so, and they did from time to time, then the capsule with the parachute had both a strobe light and a radio beacon on it, and there were ships and helicopters and divers deployed, and they pulled them out of the ocean from time to time. Your question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, how big is the capsule?
How big is the
capsule?
Yeah, I can show you a picture at the end, but it's about that big in diameter, about that high, and it has a parabolic nose on it, obviously, and the reel and the parachute are the main components of it. Okay, I think maybe I've told you all you need to know. If this all seems pretty futuristic, here is and let me say that it was terribly dangerous to fly these airplanes. It was very hazardous duty. The pilots were very skilled, and for my money, they were brave men. Here's one just as it's being snagged by a 119. I don't know if you can see that, Sam. I'm sorry?
Fly under the...
No, over.
What's the drop rate when they're capturing?
I'm sorry?
What's the drop rate when they're capturing? 30 feet a second?
Yeah, about 30 feet a second. Depends a little bit on the altitude and the density, obviously. I'm sorry?
Why was it so dangerous to fly the airplane?
Because you could get all tangled up in the you know, these things could swing around like boleros and catch the props, and you could destroy the control of the airplane. Didn't happen just right. They got pretty good at it, but it was tough in the beginning. Well, anyhow, this was the this is how it was supposed to work.
Why do you need to capture this in the air?
I'm sorry?
Why do you need to capture it in the air? Why don't you just wait until it drops to the water and just push it?
Well, I guess I could answer that question. When Columbia came apart the other day, we're still looking for all the pieces over the western United States, right? And it's really a cleaner problem out in the ocean, believe it or not, because nothing else is there. And you aren't... confusing with old radiators in the desert and that kind of thing.
But why don't you just wait till it drops to the water and just put it on the water?
Well, the Soviet version of Corona, which came along a few years after it, used exactly that system. But for whatever reason, the people that designed the system decided to go for a water recovery. And by the way, remember when the Apollo astronauts came back from the moon, they all had water recovery. The Russians used land recovery. And
Air Force, not
a baby carbon. Yeah, there may have been some of that. I don't know. But anyhow, everybody wanted to be in the act. Okay, I want to hurry along. The question is, how do you put all these pieces together into a satellite and make it work? A special facility near Palo Alto, quite near Stanford, was set up by the agency and manned by Lockheed engineers, and they took the Agena vehicles, these pusher things, and added the other things that were needed to make it work. Maybe it would help if I showed you what the layout looked like. Here's, now again, I apologize, this was one of the later versions when we had two cameras and actually two buckets, two film recovery packages. But this is about the way it laid out. Here's the film supply, cassettes feeding film along these through these dancers and film paths, which are the black lines if you want to look at it closely, through the cameras, through this 70 degree platen, then on through a film path that goes to the first bucket, or goes to the first bucket and the forward, and then eventually there's a cutter and a splicer, and then it goes to the second bucket. No, actually they were commanded from the ground. There were a simple command system up from the ground. Almost, that's the amazing thing. There was very little real electronics in this thing before PCs. It was mostly an electromechanical wonder. And it was just, you can only admire what these men achieved, and women, with the technology that was available in 1958. Well, that was a long time ago. And anyhow, okay. This was the general layout. When we finally went to two cameras, when we had enough payload, why the cameras were canted 15 degrees, and that made the job for the photo interpreters a whole lot easier. Okay.
What does that extra camera?
I'm sorry, Dan?
Another camera, another blue color.
Oh, yes, I was going to come to that. In addition to that, the photo interpreter, thank you very much for that question. The question is, what was the orientation when the pictures were taken? That's a fairly important thing. The satellite carried three other kinds of cameras. One was a framing camera with a field of view of about 72 degrees, a simple camera, not very high resolution, that looked right down and took a great chunk of the Earth's surface. And there were significant geographic features that could be used as registration marks for these 10 by 120 mile strips, and they could be registered one to the other, correlated, if you will. It was also important to know how the thing was tipped, and so cameras were added, and you can actually see it on the film I'm going to show you later, horizon scanners. They were infrared horizon scanners, which took a picture of the horizon in opposite directions, perpendicular to the velocity vector. And you can, if one was higher than the other, why you saw less limb on one side and more on the other. And a very direct and easy way to calibrate what the role of the vehicle was. In addition to that, a star camera looking upward was used to take a picture of the heavens. That was a little tough when you're on the sunlit side, but it had some value. And that, too, then would tell you what the orientation of the vehicle. And all that information was used in a very skillful way by the photo interpreters to figure out where the cameras had actually been looking at the instant of photography. Okay. The data from these attitude sensors were fed in. That's really the blue box is a summary of all that. Were fed into. They took information from rate gyros, put it into little analog computers, and then use that to fire cold gas jets that would straighten it out and trim it up. And it worked pretty well. Okay, when all these pieces were fitted together in this Palo Alto facility, they were tested briefly, to be sure, put in a truck, brought down to Vandenberg, and put on a Thor rocket. And the batteries were charged up. It ran on batteries, by the way, not solar cells. The first flight occurred on 28 February 1959. Remember, the contract, this 1.5-page contract, was dated 25 April 1958. So we're 10 months later, and the first flight goes off, and it failed. It failed miserably. It blew up. And And so, by the way, did the next 11. Just one thing after another happened. They were launching at a rate of about one a month with very little telemetry or instrumentation. There was barely time to figure out what had happened, usually not enough data, and the pressure was on to fire again and see if they wouldn't get lucky. I would remind you that after Challenger blew up, we stood down the whole fleet for 3 years while we studied the problem. These people had 30 days to figure out what to do and to make the changes. And they just kept banging away. The miracle to me is that Eisenhower kept supporting them and that they kept pushing forward. It was just, today that would be the kiss of death for any program. But Eisenhower, I think, understood the importance of what was being done here and recognized how helpful it would be in his and other presidencies. Finally, number 13 went off. And, here are the actual pieces separated. The nose cone on the left with a heat shield kind of cut apart there. A roll of film that would then go into the heat shield. The cameras. And this is on exhibition at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., if you're there. And it was the last of the series. Okay. What effect? I think it's time to stop talking about hardware and show you some of the results. Here's the first one that worked, 13. That was in mid-August 1960, so really a year and a half after the program began officially, where they had success, but it was marred by a lot of problems. These flights, there were 145 of them. They took place once a month on average from Vandenberg. They returned at the end of the day 167 buckets of film over the 12 years this thing was operating. The whole program cost $600 million. It was absolutely amazing. It generated about 800,000 images of about 500,000 square miles, repetitively to be sure, because they were always interested in the same area. But let's take a look at some of the photography. Here is Moscow, downtown Moscow, with an enlargement of the Kremlin on the left. And if we had a good print instead of the 35 millimeter slides I'm using, you can actually see a line of people getting ready to go into Lenin's tomb. Now, you can see linear definition a lot better than you can see a single spot, so be careful about that. Yeah.
Were the Russians aware of all this going on from the beginning?
Probably, because they emulated this program as rapidly as they could get the technology under their belt. And they found it to their advantage. I mean, they liked it too, and I think that's why they never attacked our program. They realized that it had some real merit for stabilization. And that was the line that Eisenhower was trying to sell a number of times in his open skies policy and so on. Here was one of the first pictures. It's Soviet SAC base. You can actually see which airplanes are what kinds if you had a good version of this. See which ones have run up their engines because they've blown the snow away. Just give you an idea. Here's the big ICBM complex in Ameni Gestalo. Here's Soviet nuclear tests before and after the shot. And at Semipalatinsk, which was their nuclear test site. Here is the ICBM test site at what we would call Tyratam or Baikonur, down by the Sea of Aralsk. And that's where they launched their first ICBM and space shots from. Here's the Sereshchagan. It's on Lake Balkhash. It's a vast complex that was devoted to building an ABM system. Yes, the Soviets were way ahead of us in that department and actually deployed one around Moscow. But this was their test facility. They launched test missiles into Sereshchagan from the Ukraine at about 1,000-mile range and then shot them down with various devices tested here. Here's a Soviet tank division and garrison. You can keep track of that kind of thing very nicely. Here is a surface-to-air missile site, SA-2 sites, which were helpful for the war planners. Here is a big atomic energy facility, reactors at Tomsk in the USSR. Here's a solid rocket motor production facility. I forget where this one is. It's Riyadh. And here's a fairly dramatic one. This is submarine building facility at Severodvinsk up in the northern part of the USSR. It's taken a good sun angle and a lot of snow, so the shadows rather dramatically highlight what's going on there. It was an enormous facility. Here is Lop Nor. It's the Chinese test site out in the middle of the Taklamakan Desert, where I've been. And that's the shot after they blew the first one. Here's their gaseous diffusion plant where they separated U-235 from uranium hexafluoride at Lanzhou in sort of southern China. I'm sorry?
What's the resolution?
This is, if you had a good reproduction, I'm going to show you some good things in a minute. It eventually went down to 2 meters, 6 feet. 6 feet. There were some problems with that, but it was in those days, it was spectacular. Let me just address the question of what kind of impact did this have on national intelligence. We've heard a lot about failed intelligence of late, and bad decisions or questionable decisions being made on the basis of it. Before this photography was available, with only a few U-2 flights, there was really an enormous debate between the hawks and the doves and the government. The national estimate that was put out in 1960 said that in the following year there would be between 140 and 200 Soviet ICBMs on station ready to go. And in fact, that was the basis for some of Kennedy's claims during the 1960 election, that there was a serious bomber and a missile gap, and we ought to get on with it and get this old man out of there and do something about it. Much to his credit, Eisenhower had access to this information, knew better, and did not contradict Kennedy in order to protect Nixon. He wanted to keep the program secret.
Did Nixon and, know about it?
How's that?
Did Nixon know about it?
Yes, and he was told by the boss to keep quiet. Much to his credit, Eisenhower arranged to have Kennedy briefed on this material, and the minute he saw it, he stopped. He was a very honest guy. I worked for him. I liked him a lot. But the question is, when the first corona went up, that estimate suddenly dropped overnight. The hawks and the doves came together, and they said, well, in a year's time, we might have 10 or 25 missiles facing us. In fact, there were only six. And Kennedy then was presented with the reality that we were way ahead of the Russians. That, of course, strengthened his hand in dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis, but unfortunately, it didn't stop there. As time went on, we, as indicated in some of the previous slides, and more payload became available because the Thor got better. We added a second camera for stereoscopic and a second cassette so we could continue to run the mission while bringing some film back. We extended the mission life from a few days to a couple of weeks, and we increased the film load to, I think, 120 pounds per bucket at the last. In the next 12 years, Corona, as I indicated, will fly 145 times. The coverage that I've been describing made an extraordinary contribution to stability. It was really like turning a big searchlight on in a completely darkened warehouse. Suddenly everything was exposed and we knew where we were. And it kept, I think, the presidents steady. I think it kept the nerves of the successive presidents steady, that they couldn't be frightened, and they didn't have to worry about what might be. They really knew what was going on, and they could act in a very responsible way to cut down both the appropriation requests from the military services and to rein in SAC and the military planners. And I think probably the same thing happened in the Soviet Union, although they had better information than we. Corona wasn't the last of it, it was the first of it. Just as Corona made its last flight in May 1972, its successor, and I can't say very much about today, but Philip Taubman has described fully in his book, Secret Empire, came online and took over the job. Wide area coverage at much higher resolution, made the photo interpreter's job a heck of a lot easier. Other kinds of satellites, eventually there was real-time readout from the satellite, so you didn't have to recover the film buckets, and it simply came down as it should on a microwave link. But I guess what I would say is that when all these programs are eventually declassified, and I hope that will be soon, we were talking about at lunch, I think the American people, the people that really paid for this program and its successors, will learn about a space technology program that was every bit as impressive as Apollo. Apologies to Sam. Every bit as impressive as Apollo. They both played an important role. Apollo really kept morale up, self-confidence up for the American people. It was on TV. It made us feel okay about our technical standing. The more important role, I think, was that the Corona program and programs like it tended to steady the president down, to give him the resolve and the wisdom and the perspective to make the right decisions and keep things in hand. I think in retrospect, it was just an amazing program. And before I take questions, I'd just like to say that these photographs, as reproduced in the slides, aren't much. Those are test photographs about circa 1962 you can look at. They're taken, I think the top one is on a north-south pass, is sort of the Mojave Desert going into San Fernando Valley or someplace like it. And that's the kind of film that the photo interpreters actually looked at. So you can make your own judgment about it. And if anyone has a glass, you can look at it. Okay, now questions. David, you get the first one.
Well, let's just...
Actually, two questions. One was, there are no clouds in any of the pictures.
Yes.
I mean, the orbits were fixed and you couldn't... How did you know when did that...
Well, the question is, what about cloud cover? You can't look at optical frequencies through clouds, and that's right. In fact, there were areas in Siberia which were of great interest, which weren't photographed for what, as much as 18 months, Hal? We were looking for ABM facilities out there, and there were long downtimes. There were weather satellites that were being fielded, and their data fed in, and so they didn't waste film on areas they knew would probably be cloud covered, but it and that accounts for some of those on-off gaps in the track I showed you. I'm sorry.
I didn't know there were weather satellites up by 59.
Sure, weather satellites. Both NASA and the Air Force put up weather satellites. They were in about 300-mile orbits, in roughly the same orbit. By the way, their data came down at very low resolution, but good enough to spot cloud formations. And their data did come down by radio from the beginning. One was called Tyros, Nimbus, NOAA, and the Air Force, I don't know what it was called. They just took one or two to do the job. It wasn't a big deal. They were not a major program. And the airplane drivers also used that kind of data. Who else has a question? Tony?
This is really amazing stuff, but at lunch we discussed the war in Iraq. And the conclusion, your answer was that even though these reconnaissance satellites are so amazing, you still need intelligence on the ground to find whatever they're finding, looking for, to find a weapons.
The question, as I understand it, is that as interesting as these are, they don't seem to help us in finding weapons of mass destruction if there are such in Iraq. And what are, really by implication, what are the limitations and what, in a way, I think an even deeper question is, what did this success do to the other collection activities? The fact is that this sort of thing was such a wow. I mean, it was terrific. And it didn't cost very much, and it happened real quick. And the presidents loved to look at the pictures. They could look at them and make their own decisions. And that was really charming. You'd see Eisenhower rolling out those pictures and looking at them, as described by Andy Goodpaster. But the fact is that we overreacted to this resource. The people said, we don't need a clandestine service. We don't need code breaking anymore. And that was a bad decision, a bad reaction, just the wrong reaction. So they kept pouring money into more and more exotic satellites, not like the cheap early version that sort of did the job, but into really wonderful new machines. But the fact is that the other elements in a balanced collection program withered and were spurned sometimes, and we're paying the price for that mistake now. There's simply no way that these satellites can find a small cache of chemical weapons.
Thank you.
And that was, that would have been apparent to the people who designed this first system. But somehow it got lost and the enthusiasm swelled. Perhaps some of you have been part of those discussions, but we just did it wrong. David?
Something that always confused me a lot is that the Russians were doing a similar thing.
Yes.
Not as good. They caught up. We knew what they were doing. They knew what we were doing. Why the secrecy?
Why
was it such a, I mean, even in the Cuban Missile Crisis, was it such a big deal to allow Stevenson to show those photographs? And forever since, there's been this over secrecy.
I think David's question is the following, for those of you in the back of the room, that if the Russians were doing this and we were doing this and we both had a pretty clear idea of one another's programs, why did it remain such a big secret from the American and the Russian taxpayers? Good question. I'm not sure. I think I know the answer. When you create these classified environments to do work in, you tend to create document control systems, clearance systems, document security officers, people that run vaults, all that sort of thing. And pretty soon you have a cottage industry that employs a lot of people. And if you were to do away with the secrecy of these programs, a lot of people would suddenly have to find work that have probably done nothing else in their lives but this kind of thing. And so they generate a lot of arguments, not all of which are silly, about how you want to keep the technical edge. And so there's a whole pleading advocacy system that tries to justify the continuation of the secrecy. My own view is that this stuff should have been declassified long ago. I take my hat off to Al Gore, who really drove it through. Someone at lunch asked me what caused Clinton to finally take at least this first program out of the bottle. And the answer was that environmental concerns, which were close to Al Gore's heart, he, as I explained at lunch, if you go to a doctor and you got something wrong and he takes an x-ray or a CAT scan, he says, God, I wish I had one taken 10 years ago. I could see if this thing grew. Well, so it is with the environment. Except we have those x-rays taken 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. You've just been looking at them. To be sure, not all in just the right places. But in fact, there were enough test shots like those made that in fact you can trace some of the major progressions of environmental alterations, most of them deteriorations. The advancement of the sand in the Kalahari Desert, for instance, the whole destruction of the Sea of Aralsk is apparent in these photographs, although they were being taken for quite a different purpose. And when that case was made to Gore, he said, I think he talked Clinton into cutting this body of data. The technology is irrelevant, it's so ancient. But the data is just priceless as a reference point to what the surface of the Earth looked like. And it really does a pretty good job of, it's given a whole new perspective and a calibration long ago, and I wish that they would take the next couple of systems and declassify them. But I think it's just it's self-enlightened interest and inertia. Yeah.
So
Dan?
Have the Russians released theirs so that we can see the progression of our own environment?
Yes. 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 The question is, what about have the Russians released their data? They have released it in the sense that they sell it, and they're looking for currency, and I'll think in a moment what there's actually a company that operates out of Washington and in Europe that sells data out of those archives, and it's some of it's pretty good, and it sort of tends to complement ours because they were interested in different parts of the world than we were, and not quite as good at any given point of time, but you know, you can time shift, you can change that, straighten that out. Do you remember the name of that outfit? I'm sorry?
You can get it on the net.
Yeah, probably. It's anyhow, it's a commercial venture, and yeah. Dan, you had one. I'm sorry.
You alluded to the fact that there were other sorts of photographs being taken before this system, U2 and
yes.
Other things. both with respect to the environment and with respect to military issues, what was the nature of the improvements that the satellite provided?
Well, the question is, what did satellites add that for instance, the U-2 and other airplane flights had not? The fact is that first rickety flight, number 14, of Corona brought back more photography than all of the U-2 flights combined. It gave enormous area. The U-2 essentially put a needle through the country very occasionally. This thing mowed the whole lawn once a month. And that's just an enormous difference. Now, the U-2 had better resolution, but not that much better.
The U-2
could be shut down. Yeah. And so it was the broad perspective. And the U-2, by definition, had to go where it was likely that there was a target. It's like the drunk who looks for his keys under the streetlight. But if the keys aren't under the streetlight, you're going to miss it. And so the U-2 missed a lot of things, simply because there were no strong enough indicators to get the priority to plan the routes over those areas. And so it was a fundamental revolution in the way reconnaissance was done. And now with the resolution today where it is in real-time readout, it really is terrific. But it has its limits. Yes, Jim.
Feldman's book is a rather heavy editorial message, and he clearly feels that there was a flexibility under Eisenhower in particular that doesn't exist today. The military-industrial complex would not today be so much able to take advantage of new technology or change techniques.
I think Jim's question is a contrast the situation I'm describing here where this was done with today. Yeah, I mean, it's just, no, I think it's just light years apart. People have asked me, the guys in the present administration, you know, what about it? And I say, look, there's simply no way I could do today what I did then, by a couple of orders of magnitude. There are simply so many people in the act, most of whom are well-intentioned, but frankly, they're not very good technically. Remember that there were just a few people who really understood science pretty damn well, and they made the decisions, and they could communicate with people like me who knew enough physics to know what they were talking about, and people like Drell and Garwin are clearly good physicists. It doesn't take very many of those people to provide the navigational function, and then you need some good implementers, and fortunately we had those. They were both in industry and also at the agency that knew how to get things done, both in the Air Force and the agency. The Air Force people were very good. And so I think that the whole situation in Washington has changed. To do this kind of a program today would probably take 12 years to do what we did in 10 months today. There's simply so many hoops to go through and so much. I think it's wrong to be critical, to criticize a different era. But I don't understand what they do with their time and money. I really don't.
I hate to stop on that note.
Okay.